Oh, Roberto, I just love teaching and I love my students, every one of them, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Even the ones that people would say are difficult. If you teach them properly and do what you're supposed to do, then they don't remain difficult very long.
This is the Interdisciplinary Life Podcast, Episode 4. In this episode, I talked to Carolyn Miyakawa Adams about internment camp, teaching in the Berkeley Unified School District, and I make a case for renaming Washington Elementary School the Carolyn Miyakawa Adams Elementary School. Hello, and welcome to the Interdisciplinary Life Podcast, Episode 4. In this episode, I talked to Carolyn Miyakawa Adams. Mrs. Adams was in internment camps in the United States during World War II. She later went to the University of California at Berkeley, or Cal, as we locals call it. And she then became a teacher in the Berkeley Unified School District. She was, in fact, my teacher in the Berkeley Unified School District, and she's someone who had a huge impact on me as a student and as a person, both as a child and going into my adult life. And I reconnected with Mrs. Adams for a couple of reasons. One was personal. I just wanted to let her know how much she meant to me. But also because recently, Berkeley has decided to rename two elementary schools that are currently named for Jefferson and Washington. But with everything that's happened in 2020, the big push for social change and greater recognition of people of color, Berkeley has decided to change the names of those two schools. And when I heard that, I was inspired to mount a campaign to rename Washington for Mrs. Adams. I think it's really important to name a local school for a local educator. We often name buildings for presidents and political figures and people of national importance, and that's fine. What I would like to see is more recognition of people on a local level. And particularly, I think it would be nice to see a school named for a teacher who taught in that building, who had an impact on the lives of the students in that building and in that community. We don't have schools here named for teachers. We also have no schools named for an Asian American, and I think that's another piece of representation that would be great in renaming Washington Elementary for Carolyn Miyakawa Adams. We're joined in this interview by Carolyn's son, John Adams, who was invaluable in helping set this up and joining in and helping fill in some of the details for us during the interview. We're going to cover Mrs. Adams growing up, going to camp, coming back to Berkeley, and her career, and then eventually her thoughts on someone trying to get a school named after her. So, for the next 40 minutes or so, I hope you'll enjoy the story of Carolyn Miyakawa Adams.
Well, Roberto, we're at your pleasure, man.
Well, first of all, it's so wonderful to see you, Mrs. Adams. And it makes me so happy.
Well, you just don't know how happy it makes me to see my former students, and especially, you know, my favorite ones.
So Roberto told me the story, Mom, where you saw him fundamentally wandering around the halls of Washington, mm-hmm. and you pretty much said, you know, you introduced yourself, asked him what he was doing, and at that point, you marched him down to the office and said, this gentleman's in my class.
Boy, that was sure a smart thing I did.
Well, it worked out. Do you remember that?
Vaguely, I do remember.
Do you remember that year you had me and you also had Mineo Nomura, who was a visiting student from Japan? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that might have been part of why you brought me in.
I don't think so.
you stood on your own accord, Roberto.
Roberto, I just wanted you.
Yeah. Well, I think it was nice for me, I know. And I hopefully it was nice for me now that there were three of us. There was myself being half Japanese, and then Mineo from Japan. And then there was another kid who is Japanese American in that class too.
I wonder who that was.
I'm trying to remember his name. I don't remember, but I know the three of us got along quite well.
What year was that?
Okay, now I have to do math. Let's see. I think it was about 1983.
Okay.
So 1983, Mom. So I was 22. Mm-hmm. And do you remember those years at Washmo? I mean, it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
So I guess just starting off, you know, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about yourself and about your time growing up, I think, in Sacramento. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my parents were June and Agnes Miyakawa. And I was born in Sacramento, and we lived on a place called X Street. I grew up in Sacramento. No, I didn't grow up in Sacramento, but I was born there, and we were there until the war started. And then we had to go to the Tule Lake concentration camps. Do you remember Tule Lake? Our parents, who were so strong and wonderful, and they always, I always knew that I was, you know, going to go to college, and they were actually, my father was talking to me about going to Harvard, because he graduated from Harvard in the class of 26, one of the very few Asians at that time. And so, as I say, I remember how strong they were, and, you know, once we left the camps, how they must have been so worried, because, as I said, you know, people were unpleasant and we never knew what was going to happen. But they just remained strong and until the very end. And when you have parents like that, it's wonderful, and you probably aren't going to fail and give up or anything like that. So
did your dad, he came from Japan?
He did. He came when he was a child.
Really? That's very early.
When he came, his own parents he said, you know, about a week after he arrived, they said, "You have to go to school now, and it's that way." And instead of doing what most of us would have done, which is to go and hover over him and that sort of thing. And so he went, my parents supported us in every way, and yet, you know, they expected us to do what we had to do too. So
do you know why your grandparents came to America?
I'm not sure. Do you remember, John?
I don't. I mean, you could argue, Roberto, that, you know, my mom is Nisei, since her parents came over at such a young age. But I don't know what the catalyst was.
So I know. So for my family, the story always was that it was because of the end of feudalism. You know, my great-grandfather was from an upper tier family, right, in the feudal system, and then that went away. There's no more need for the gentry or whatever, and he was the youngest son, so he didn't stand to inherit anything. Mm-hmm. And so he came to America because he figured this was, you know, he's a sojourner essentially at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And my great-grandmother was an arranged marriage between the families. So they had never met, and he was about 20 years older than her, I believe. And she came over on a boat that was, you know.
Yeah, you know, Roberto, that sounds kind of like my family, okay? They were in the samurai class,
mm-hmm.
and then they did a riot with the samurai class, and all of a sudden they had to, I guess when you were a samurai, you didn't have to earn a living.
Right, you were sort of, you were pledged to your lord, and yes. you, yeah. know, you worked, you were like, you know, part of their little army or whatever, but it was... They gave you a place to live and food, and yeah, you didn't, I mean, that was your job. That's just, so your dad lived here, and did he live in the West Coast, or did he grow up somewhere else?
He lived here in the West Coast, in Sacramento.
Okay. And then went to Harvard.
Yes.
And what did, so then what did he end up doing as a career?
Well, he ended up, he majored in international law, but as a non-citizen, he couldn't get a job. So he finally became a real estate agent.
Well, didn't he go back to Japan for a period of time?
He did for a while. And then he came back and started the real estate business.
Mm-hmm.
Did he do anything else?
No, I think, I mean, that was, and, you know, he was successful. It's, you know, I suspect he would have been a successful attorney, but
mm-hmm.
situation dictated else otherwise, and he ran a very, very good business.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, lost a fair amount of it during the internment.
Yeah.
And came out and had to rebuild again, which mm-hmm. he did.
Well, and he had two brothers who also went to Harvard. No, just one of them went to Harvard. I can't remember where the other one went. And then he had a sister who was an opera star. I have a picture of her singing, guess what, Madam Butterfly.
Go figure.
Yes.
That's called typecasting.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Delightful,
but she received wonderful, you know, she taught it, she sang it in France.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember what the theater was, but yeah, to see an actually a real Japanese woman singing Madam Butterfly.
And so then what about your mother?
Well, my mother also came from the samurai class, but her parents came and they finally ended up in Florin, which is close to Sacramento, farming. And so it was a hard life, but I didn't realize, you know, my mother did a lot of reading. One of my favorite authors is Jane Austen, and my mother liked Jane Austen too. So, yeah.
And your brother wrote a book, right?
Who?
Your brother wrote a book?
Oh, my brother, yes. He wrote a book about Tule Lake.
Mm-hmm. You gave me a copy at my wedding.
Oh, okay. So I'm just going to say, I'll give you a copy.
I have one. I have one. You know, I minored in Asian American studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a whole shelf of my Japanese American and Asian American cultural books.
That's a wonderful major to have.
Absolutely. So how old were you when you went to camp?
I was about 7 years old, not 17.
Not 17, seven. Not quite that old, huh?
No.
I know that my grandmother was probably about 17 or so when she went.
Uh-huh.
So you were seven, so that's about like a second grade or so, you know, elementary school. And did you end up staying throughout the whole time of the war?
No. My father and mother decided that it wasn't good for us to be there, so we left after a year. You could sign, what numbers were they?
I think the loyalty oath.
There was a loyalty oath, and if you signed it, you could leave. After about a year at Tule Lake, the only thing I can remember is that about Tule Lake is that I wasn't that unhappy because I was with my grandparents and my aunts and uncles, and I always enjoyed that. But I was very sad when we started leaving because they didn't leave. They were waiting at the, well, there actually were barbed wire fences and they were waiting there. And we, my mother, father, and my brother, who was a little younger than I am, our neighbor in Sacramento brought our car and our dog because he took care of both of them. And then I don't know how he got home, but he left. And then we got in the car and we started driving. And somewhere my parents found out that there in Colorado Springs, there was a wonderful family who were willing to help the Japanese who needed help. So they moved out of the house and let us move there. And then we stayed there for a while. My father tried to find jobs, but because he was Japanese probably, and also he wasn't a citizen. He and my mother, even though they pretty much grew up in the United States, they Japanese American or Japanese couldn't become citizens at that point. So they he couldn't get a job, and he finally decided that we had to move from Colorado Springs, and so we moved to Boulder, and that's where I grew up, Boulder, Colorado. And it was I have to say that they were very nice to us. Okay, it was hard getting there because people on the street still hated the Japanese, and they would yell at us and tell us to go back, and they called us Japs, which is really hard for me even now to hear. And so then he, well, we went to Sacramento, and then it's and I went to McClatchy High School, and then junior college, Sacramento Junior College. And after 2 years, I went to Cal Berkeley and graduated with a degree in, well, in education, teaching and child development. Yes, I started teaching in Berkeley and I taught there for many, many years. And that's where I met you.
That's where you met me, and thank goodness for me that you did.
Well, thank goodness for me. Well, you know, one thing that I forgot to, or I didn't mention, that when I was at Cal, I belonged to a group called Project Pakistan India Ceylon. Have you heard of that group?
No, what's that?
Well, it was kind of based on, I believe at UCLA, they had a group that was interested in India and Asia. And so we decided while we were going to Cal that we were interested. And so we got a professor who taught those subjects, and we started studying. And then we decided that we wanted to go there. So they picked a travel team. And I think there were about eight of us, okay, seven students and one graduate student. And we went to India, and we also went to Pakistan. And it was just a wonderful experience. One reason I was interested was my father was always interested in those countries too. So I kind of grew up with it. And then when I got a chance, I just loved it. And we went around to different universities and talked to the students there about the USA. And well, everybody, as I say, they were at that time, not very many American students went to any of those countries. So even the, well, one of the people who really were interested were the people who ran the universities. And so it was something that I learned so much from.
I mean, and I have to say, you know, it's very touching for me personally that you remember me, and I figure you've had literally hundreds of students, if not over 1,000 during your career, probably. And, mm-hmm. You know, for you to be able to still remember a couple, I'm sure a lot of people have told you over the years that you were their favorite teacher, but you were definitely my favorite teacher and someone who I've often in my life thought about and looked up to for the example that you set as an educator.
Thank you, Roberto. That makes me so happy to hear you say that. Okay. I did love teaching, and I loved my students, and the ones like you made it so wonderful. So thank you.
I feel like I was kind of a handful maybe, but I appreciate it.
I just, you know, I'm just thinking about my teaching time, and it just meant so much to me. And as again, I'll say again, having students like you made it just wonderful and so worthwhile for me. And as I say, I've got wonderful memories of all the things we did together. We went on field trips, remember? Mm-hmm. And students came in from Cal.
Yep. I remember one time when we took the afternoon, the class, and we went up leafleting to try to get Cal students to come to class. You had all you had all 30 of us running around Sproul.
Yes, I remember.
Just randomly walking up to nice looking students and saying, would you like to come volunteer for our class?
She had me doing that too, and I wasn't even a student.
So you graduated from Cal and you started working at BUSD. Do you know about how long you were at Washington?
You know, Roberto, I can't remember, but I could probably do a little research and find out.
But it seems like it was a good long time.
Well, it was for a while, because I taught for something over 30 years. And I taught in several different schools. But
did you teach at Washington when I was a student there?
I don't remember. Do you?
I'm pretty sure, because I remember helping Corrine Howard and some of the other your other cohorts. So Robert, if we use just my time at Washington, how old are you in the first grade?
About six.
Six. Mm-hmm. So if I'm 59 and I was at Washington when I was 6 years old, that's a long time, Mom.
It was a little while.
Actually, did you teach with Corrine Howard? And
yeah, I remember Corrine. I wonder if Roberto remembers Corrine Howard.
I don't. I remember Dr. Fishman.
Yes. Yeah, he was a wonderful principal, the best I've ever had.
He was fantastic. And then I had you, and I believe there was Ms. Merritt was there. She was down the hall, but she had a different last name.
Barrett?
Merritt, like the late, yeah, I think so. Oh, well, she was down the hall there on the second floor.
Merritt. Uh-huh.
But she had a different name when she was at Washington, because then she went over to Longfellow and she was Miss Merritt.
Uh-huh.
I had Mr. Harula for kindergarten.
I don't remember. How do you spell that?
Well, I was five, so I'm going to have to try to put it together. I think it was kind of how it sounds. H-A-R, maybe O-U-L-A.
Oh, okay.
But he would have been a bit older. So, but he was a very nice kindergarten teacher. I enjoyed him. But, you know, I bounced around. So until I went to Berkeley High, I never went to the same school 2 years in a row.
Oh.
Because I went from Washington, we moved over to like Milvia Cedar. So I went to Whittier.
Uh-huh.
And then they closed Whittier to turn it into the magnet school. So they bused us to Oxford. And then I moved again. So then I came back to Washington.
Yes. And then were you ever at Hillside?
No.
Okay. Because I did teach at Hillside.
Yeah, I went to Longfellow and I did after school care at what's now Sylvia Mendez. And then I went to school in Oakland for a couple of years. I spent a year in Europe with my mother. And then Whittier and then Berkeley High, or Whittier, mm-hmm. Willard and then Berkeley High. You know, John sent some wonderful photographs of you while you were at Cal. Is that where you met your husband?
Where did I meet Jerry?
Well, so my biological dad, so Carol Tyson, yes, you did. You guys met at Cal.
Uh-huh.
And then I was the result of that.
Mm-hmm. Then, as course, a result.
Yeah. And then, of course, you ultimately remarried to Dad.
Uh-huh.
And
we met in Berkeley, didn't we?
Yeah, you guys lived in the same apartment complex down on Sacramento Street.
Yes, that's right. And he was a wonderful husband and a wonderful father to Jerry, to Johnny. But he died around 2000, and this is the house that we bought where we are right now. And it was it's been so hard because I miss him, but as I said, he was a wonderful father to John and a wonderful husband for me, and so I was lucky. I was lucky to have him.
And what did he do?
So Dad was a Navy trained electrician,
mm-hmm.
who ultimately went to work at the UC campus in Tolman Hall as a technical support resource, and then ultimately went on to self-taught programming and did some work for the Berkeley Labs around systems testing and I think rolling out some initial IBM RTs maybe, or whatever their high-powered initial small computer was. So self-taught, but always in the technical realm.
That's very cool. It's a very Berkeley kind of story.
Well, I have no technical knowledge or skills or ability. So I'm glad John's here to tell me.
Well, I will say one more thing, Roberto, when you talk about a Berkeley upbringing, so my dad and mom were, you know, I they've been described as PhD level supporters of classical music. And then you can add literature to my dad's equation as well. So it was a very eclectic upbringing, and certainly through mom and dad, we were exposed to quite a bit, which leads to making interesting individuals.
It certainly seems that way. And so Mrs. Adams, when I talked to John before, I understand that you guys essentially had a house without a television back then. Mm-hmm. Was that right?
Yes.
But a lot of books.
Yes. And I still feel the same way. I think it's so much more important for children to have books than a television.
Going back to the TV thing, right? When you start talking about a say-do ratio, you know, my mom started in education as a reading specialist. So she really did practice what she believed and certainly employed at home. And then that branched into running her own classroom.
Actually, Johnny, I started teaching first.
You were a reading specialist first?
No.
Oh, okay. Take that all back.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, though, because I think that Berkeleyness and that mindset and that approach has really not just rubbed off on, say, my generation, but just been maintained, because my mom raised me in a very similar way. And like my kids, you know, they don't watch TV Monday through Friday, or really Monday through Thursday.
Good for you.
And then they each get to choose a half hour of programming on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So they have limited TV time. And in some ways now, if like, if they want to watch a movie, they have to be very cooperative because they each only get 30 minutes. But if they watch a movie that's going to be 90 minutes or 2 hours, you know, we'll let them stretch a little bit if they're all working together and agreeing. And so it's been interesting to see as they get older, what that apportionment of TV time ends up looking like. You know, obviously teachers have a huge impact on the lives of their students. And as an elementary school teacher, I think you have a great impact on, again, even if it was 28 or 30 or more years teaching on hundreds of students. But you also, when you weren't teaching, you still did tutoring and other kinds of community work. Can you tell me a little bit about what you remember about that?
Well, when I retired from teaching, I had quite a few friends who were still teaching. And so I would go into their classrooms and tutor the students that needed help. And I always enjoyed doing that because I did spend some of my teaching years as a reading teacher. So I just used the same skills that I learned and used the same materials. And it's always so wonderful to help a student and then all of a sudden realize that that student has really learned so much and is going to make it.
Yeah. And you worked with students or kids in your neighborhood as well, is that right?
Well, if somebody needed some help, I would try to do that. I had a lot of leftover materials and things, and so that's what I did. You know, I gave the parents anything they needed in books and worksheets and things like that. And then if they wanted my help, then I did it.
So Mom, Roberto, I'm gonna jump in for a minute. Mom, it may not be high on the memory radar because to you it was just second nature, but you certainly tutored a lot of the kids in the neighborhood on Spalding. Mm-hmm. So Roberto, we lived on Spalding between Bancroft and Channing. And we were fortunate that there were quite a large number of kids, you know, my age and then plus or minus 5 years, you know, of note, Clyde L. Washington and the Washington family were right across the street. And I know you certainly helped out with Kenny and Michael, and there was, you know, Mark, I mean, pick a name in the neighborhood and you probably helped tutor them.
Yeah.
And the reason I remember that is a lot of the times you and Dad would go together. So you would tutor and then Dad would help work on their motorcycles or their cars or and so I mean it's a pretty vivid memory in my mind. Mm-hmm. Like I said, second nature to you.
Yeah. Well, it was a wonderful thing for me because Roberto, I just loved teaching and I loved my students, every one of them. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Even the ones that people would say are difficult. If you teach them properly and do what you're supposed to do, then they don't remain difficult very long. Okay. And so by the end of the year, we were very, very close and it was always so hard to say goodbye to them. But then look at this, after all these years, I'm sitting here talking with you. So the other day, a student named Sean Gardier, he called me and he said that he remembers me as a teacher and he'd like to get together. So we were planning on it and then something happened. I think his father got sick. So we're supposed to meet next month and I'm gonna tell him about you.
Well, and you know, I think you're touching, you and John both, on what I, you know, understand now as an adult, and maybe didn't as much as a kid, but that you really did have this great, not just affection, but belief in your students, and that they could achieve success, both sort of academically and in the social emotional realm. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I guess, what would you say about your philosophy or your approach? Like, how are you able to connect with that many students in on such a deep level and see so much in them?
Well, I truly did believe in my students, okay? I knew they were all smart. They could learn anything and be of a wonderful person, you know, supporting others and having a great life. And I always made sure that the students knew that. And I believed it. I really did. I believed every student, no matter how difficult, when they came in, they were going to end up, and we were going to have a wonderful classroom together. And it was wonderful to see everybody, all the students, liking each other and helping each other. And it isn't just that I believed it. It was the way it really was.
Yeah. I mean, I told John this when I talked to him before, that being in your classroom is the first time that I felt as a kid that someone in the educational system really saw me. You know, I wasn't just in a classroom, but I felt recognized and valued. And that was really a special thing.
Yeah, and I spent a lot of time with the parents too, because sometimes the parents would feel a little discouraged, you know, especially if their child hadn't done too well or was having problems. And so I spent time with the parents, letting them know how wonderful their children are and that they are smart and they could achieve anything as long as we all work together on it. And Roberto, they did. I can't remember any student who wasn't really making it at the end.
Yeah, I remember my, my grandmother helped raise me quite a bit, because my mom was a single mom. And my grandmother would invoke your name at times to try to get me to do things that she needed me to do. She'd say, you know, Mrs. Adams told me that you can do this, or Mrs. Adams, you know, said that, you know, this is what happens in class. And so my grandmother definitely, you know, had a lot of communication with you and really liked you a lot, because you both have very similar background. And she definitely leaned on the things that you said to her.
Hey, Roberto, one of the, going back to this, the interaction that my mom would have with her students' parents, you know, everybody talks about the parent teacher conference week, but as a young student at Washington, I'd finish up my day and then I'd go visit my mom and fundamentally hang out with her in her classroom for as long as she was there, which, you know, typically would go till 5, 6, or 7. But there were always parents sitting down and meeting with my mom. So there was no such thing as parent teacher week. It just happened all the time, right? So the interaction that my mom either drove or welcomed on the our students' parents' side, you know, once again, was just pretty much ongoing. It wasn't you prepared and, you know, for 1 week of it. It was always there.
And then I learned recently that you also had a scholarship set up. What was that through?
The JACL. I'm a member of the Berkeley JACL, And every year I contribute money for scholarships for the students, because they always give student scholarships. So that's, again, something I feel that's important to do.
And can you just, for the people who don't know, can you say, tell us what JACL is and how you've been involved?
It's called the Japanese American Citizens League. And it's a group of, well, at this point, it's getting to be more interracial, but at one time it was Japanese people, and my father and mother were members, and that's how I found out about it. And what they're trying to do is, and you hear this a lot, okay, people are very concerned about what happened to the Japanese Americans and Japanese during World War II. And one reason, and the JACL is working very hard to make sure that it never happens again to any other group. Mm-hmm. And that's, they do other things, you know, like give scholarships but that's the thing that I like most about it, is that they're very concerned about you know educating people so that, you know, Muslims and other people like that are not exposed to what we went through.
I feel like I might know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask anyway. Did you ever think about your legacy?
You mean being Japanese?
I mean being remembered in the community for your works.
No.
It never occurred to you, huh?
Hey, Roberto?
Yeah?
I'm going to jump in. That's just not even on her radar, man.
I get that sense, you know, but it's one of those things where, like, you think you know the answer, but you still ask the question just to see. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like everything that you do is just kind of what you do, you know?
Yeah, yes.
So as someone who sort of gave selflessly for decades to others, when you heard when John said one of your students wants to try to get a school named after you, what did you think of that?
Oh, I thought, what did I think? Well, to tell you the truth, okay, first in my mind has always been my students and how important they were to me and how much I appreciate them and love them. And so if I'm remembered by some of my students, at least, that's the most important thing to me, okay? It doesn't matter to me if a school is named in my honor or anything like that. What I want is as many students as possible to contact me and do what we're doing right now, visiting and sharing. That's, Roberto, you just, you know, that's so important to me, and I thank you so much for this.
Well, you've been a lasting presence in my life all the way through from third grade to now. You know, I think about you a lot. I think about what I learned from you. And it's been really great getting the perspective of being an adult and a parent and an educator. Because as I get that experience, I see and remember the things that you did in a new way. You know, like as becoming an educator, I now understand the pedagogy behind a lot of the things that you did with us as kids that I didn't understand from that perspective back then. And so my appreciation of you grows as I get older. And as I see, you know, again, and being a parent and seeing my kids and their teachers and the ones that I recognize as having those same qualities.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Roberto, I got to jump in for a minute here. So when I first told my mom, I remember the look. It was a smile, a pause. And then her words were something along the lines of, "That's very cool. That's great. But does this mean I get a chance to reconnect with Roberto?" So, you know, is good as a school renaming sounds, reconnecting with you had candidly a much bigger impact for my mom.
Yes, that's really true.
I believe it. Well, let me ask you this then, in a more general sense, because I feel like this is another aspect of this for me as I've sort of thought about this idea and putting this forth, is there's a couple other pieces here. I'll ask you, do you think that there's value in naming a school for an educator rather than another type of notable person?
Yes, I think so too. I think that it's a wonderful thing to think about. Well, education is at the bottom of all education are teachers and students. So, no, I think it's a wonderful idea, Roberto. But as I say, I don't have to, it doesn't have to be me. I sure wish that someone like Frank Fisher were still alive and we could honor him. You know, he had quite a bit of difficulty with Berkeley Unified because at some point, I mean, he always put teachers and students first. And that's not always the way it is today.
I think you're touching on something else that has come up as I've had these conversations is obviously Washington and Berkeley in general has had innumerable fantastic educators. Mm-hmm. And so you could pick any one of them, absolutely, and you couldn't go wrong. But just in that general sense of we name schools for activists and we've named schools for political figures. And I don't think that it occurs to people to name schools after educators. Mm. You know, I think it's great that we have Rosa Parks as a school in our district. I think it's great that we have Sylvia Mendez as a school in our district. Sylvia Mendez primarily did her work in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Part of it is I would like to see one of our local schools named for someone who had an actual impact on the kids in this community.
What do you think about Frank Fisher?
I didn't know him as well. I think Frank Fisher is great. I think that would be a great choice as well.
I think that would be a wonderful thing to name a school after him because he made such a difference to all of us. And when we were getting, there were some people who were deciding, you know, that they knew more about education than we did and what we should be teaching the students. He absolutely stuck by the teachers that he knew were well succeeding with teaching the kids what they needed to know. And I can probably think of others, but Dr. Fisher is the one that comes to mind.
Well, we can make that proposal as well.
Okay, good. I wish you would.
I will. I will put in Dr. Fisher as well. The other piece of it is that in a city like Berkeley, that embraces diversity, and the whole reason they want to rename the schools is because they want more diversity in the representation. And for a city that's roughly 20% Asian, we have no educational facilities named for an Asian American, which I think is another piece that I would like to see. You know, it meant a lot to me to have you as a teacher because I could relate to you. You know, it was representation, right? It was, here's someone who looks like me, who looks like my mom, who looks like my grandmother, both of whom were teachers at different points. And I felt like I was at such a crossroads in my life at that point, at a very young age, that having that additional piece to connect with helped me a lot.
You know, what I did think at some point, because I've been known as Carolyn Adams for so long, that lately I've started adding my last Japanese last name, which was Miyakawa. So I'm signing myself now Carolyn Adams Miyakawa, or Carolyn Miyakawa Adams. I think that would be better.
Well, this has been awesome. Is there anything that you want people to know about you that I haven't asked? It seems like maybe you don't want people to know anything about you. You seem very reserved, but I'm just curious.
Roberto, it was so nice to talk with you. You asked me important, pertinent questions, and I tried to answer them as best I could. I'm probably going to think of other things that I could have said, and if I do, I'll write them down and tell John, okay?
That would be fantastic. Thank you so much. It's so nice to connect with you. It's lovely to see you.
And I feel the same way, Roberto. Thank you. And I'd love to see you in person when we can.
As soon as we can. Well, you know, today, again, a momentous day. A young woman from Berkeley or Oakland or Montreal, depending on what part of her life you're looking at, but is now the vice president.
Yes.
And, you know, with everything, hopefully, eventually falling into place with a greater emphasis on science and decency, we can get through the rest of this pandemic in short order. You know, while I anticipate the kids continuing distance learning for the rest of the year, I would love to be able to get back to some amount of socialization by summer. I think that would be fantastic.
And you just said a word that's very important, decency.
Yeah, decency, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the building blocks that's been missing from public discourse for a while.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So, thank you again. I'm going to go attend to my children. You obviously have raised a fantastic human being sitting there in the car with you. Getting to meet John and know him a little bit has really been a treat.
Yeah. And thank you so much, Roberto.
All right. Well, hug all the people you're allowed to hug, and have a good rest of your day.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Roberto. Hi, John, thank you so much for your help.
Of course, man. It's a pleasure, dude.
Appreciate it. I will talk to you all later.
All right. Bye-bye.
The Interdisciplinary Life Podcast was written and directed by Roberto Santiago. Our theme song is David Koresh by Abundant Society, all produced in association with NTDL Productions.
Recording.
We are.